Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now your calls on the life of Robin Williams for the rest of our time today. As you no doubt know, dead of an apparent suicide at the age of 63 yesterday. We'll play a few clips from Williams' long career, including some that aren't getting that much play elsewhere, we think, though, of course, any attempt to capture the range of his work in just a few clips will inevitably fall short. But we'll take calls from anyone as first priority who had a personal connection to Robin Williams, just to remember him and his work and what he was like, if you knew him or worked with him. We're going to give priority to anyone who knew him, like we did when Lou Reed died, because we know so many of you in our audience in that field did work with him, in this case, in movies and comedy. 212-433-9692. With so many actors and comedians and filmmakers in New York, I'm sure there are people listening right now who did cross paths with Robin Williams. What are you not seeing in the many tributes and obituaries that you may want to share with your fellow listeners, a personal account or a story, a sense of him that you were able to get one-on-one or in your working group? 212-433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, the first clip we'll play is from one of the earliest appearances that he's known for. This is Robin Williams on The Tonight Show, really making America take notice, chatting with Johnny Carson, October 14th, 1981.
People always think performers don't get nervous.
Not at all, really. I don't. Oh, God. Not really. Not at all. Not really. Not me. No way.
Is there some reason you don't do? Is it the fact that you get nervous?
Very much so. I suffer from severe dyslexia, too. Oh. I was the only child in my block on Halloween to go trick or trout. People go, oh, look, here comes that young Williams boy again. Better get some fish. Here you go. Say hi to your mom and dad. Hope they find you.
Where is home for you? Or did you come from a home? Yeah. I mean,
they said, oh, the people of the institution, Tommy. If you haven't taken your medication yet, it's going to be fine.
They're back at 12.
Back at 12, yeah.
No. How are you, Mr. Williams? I'm real fine now.
Look at this thing. Look, Flipper.
Right now, there's a sound man going, what are you doing? Oh, God. I better relax. It's okay. I'm on
it's
TV.
All right, just...
You're a nice man. You won't hurt me.
No.
All right, let me just one sip.
Certainly.
Okay, thank you. Don't be afraid. The sores went away.
Is it simplex two, is it? Yeah. One or two?
A real man can stand up to herpes.
All right, Robin Williams on Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show, October 1981. And one of the visuals there, Williams was barking up into the boom mic, the mic that you never see on camera because it's above their heads, and drinking from Johnny Carson's cup. And, you know, Carson usually a pretty cool customer is just trying to keep up. And that, of course, was part of Robin Williams' brilliance, but probably in the long run, part of his psychological challenge, the incredible energy that he brought to it. And how could he keep up with himself? They say that's one of the things that drove him to cocaine. How could he keep up with himself? How could he keep that level of energy that the public was coming to depend on him for? Anyway, if you knew Robin Williams, you're going to get first priority on the phone, 212-433-WNYC. If you ever met him, worked with him on a set in a comedy club, whatever, but anyone else may call as well, 212-433-WNYC, as we remember the late, great Robin Williams today, 212-433-9692. And here's Ellen in Nyack. Hi, Ellen, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call. Yes. I was friends with a woman named Monica who was in the Rick and Ruby show in San Francisco, which was a kind of a jokey jokey song duo, and she and her partner were friends with Robin Williams when he was just starting out, and he was very, very generous to them. He had them perform at a lot of his stand-up gigs, and when she got married in the early 80s, I went to her wedding, and he was a guest there, and he was just getting started. It was probably 1981 or 1982, so he was just getting well-known, but I did know of him, and what so impressed me at this wedding was that by the punch bowl where they were serving the food, there were a lot of elderly ladies who were the servers, and he was just standing there cracking them up. Mm-hmm. He was doing one joke after another, and they were laughing so hard they could hardly serve the food.
So he was, and Ellen, I'm going to leave it there, but it's a great story of how he was kind of in a public place with regular people. Zach in West Palm Beach. You're on WNYC. Hi, Zach.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thank you. I first met Robin in 1983 at a Sabret hot dog stand on 54th and Broadway. He noticed my tenor saxophone case, and he said, "Sax, cool." And then a year later, when I saw the film, I realized that he had been in makeup and costume and on location making Moscow on the Hudson. At the time, I was doing a solo show with a rack of electronics and gave him a flyer and asked if he would come. He took the flyer and he said, send one to his manager on 57th Street. So I did. He didn't come. But fast forward to 1993. I'm in San Francisco. I'm the general manager of Music Annex Studios, and I make the deal with the L.A. Film Studio to produce the audio dailies for Mrs. Doubtfire, audio daily transfers. Robin did all his ADR dialogue recording at another studio in San Francisco, Russian Hill Recording. But he came by over to Music Annex once. I took him upstairs to our empty top floor and blew him a few notes on my saxophone. He told me he wished he could play the saxophone like me. Mm. I mean, that was so nice.
Nice story, Zach. And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Let's play a couple more clips. Two of Robin Williams that sort of helped to tell the background story to one of his most famous comedy specials. Here he is in 2006 on Fresh Air talking to Terry Gross about his early career and how he came to walk that line between stand-up comedy and wild improvisation. Take a listen.
First time I did a paying gig was at a club in Orange County called the Laugh Stop, and the whole sound system blew out. And so all of a sudden they said, "Go on." I went up there, and because I didn't need a mic to begin with, I just worked the crowd and kind of till they got the sound system back up. And it really kind of helped build a style that was more like use anything, anywhere, and with the improv background, if anyone said anything, to go off on it. Like one time in a New York club, some woman yelled out, "Dr. Roof." She was trying to say Dr. Ruth, but she'd had five gin and tonics. And I started doing Dr. Roof, who was like a black sex therapist. Mm-hmm. And you could start, mm-hmm. Man say foreplay, mm-hmm. You not done, mm-mm. You know, protection, mm-mm. Get away from me, that's my protection. Straight edge razor, mm-hmm. But it was all part of, you know, building a style that was pretty loose. And then later on, you would start to put structure to it. By the time I did Night at the Met, it was pretty, it started to have like a flow and kind of a structure. But up till then, it was pretty freeform.
So Robin Williams from Fresh Air in 2006. At the end there, he mentioned Live at the Met, that special, and balancing scripted jokes with freeform riffs. Well, here's Williams from Live at the Met. And listen for the way he flows in and out of improvisation, whipping the audience back and forth, and, of course, how openly here he talks about his addictions.
You know what I'm talking about? The Peruvian marching powder, the devil's dandruff. It's a nice thing, though. Cocaine. Mmm, what a wonderful drug. Anything that makes you paranoid and impotent, give me more of that. Mmm, what a fake thing to do. Whoop, we're back with sound again. Sorry about the sound. I got the sound from Hollywood. People in the balcony were going, "We understood him. I guess Juilliard helped for a brief moment. I could enunciate to the back row, just like Sylvester Stallone doing Hamlet. This would be a place where Stallone could do Hamlet. To be or what?" Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Jeez. We're back again. We were discussing cocaine for a brief moment. Sound crapped up, but that's why I'm using Sapaza sound. No one wants their tapes back. I wonder why. We're talking about how cocaine basically affects you. There's also something called freebasing. It's not free. It costs you your house. It should be called home basing.
Robin Williams from back then. By the way, the Fresh Air interview that we excerpted from, we just found out Terry Gross and company will be re-airing that, I guess, in full this afternoon on Fresh Air. So I'm sure many of you Robin Williams fans will want to hear that. As we take your calls right now with your recollections of Robin Williams, if you worked with him at all or knew him personally at all, as well as anyone else, 212-433-WNYC. Kim in Brooklyn. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have a memory from about 25 years ago when I was working at Books & Company. The books are on the Upper East Side. And I went in one early Sunday morning to open it with the manager. There were just the two of us there. The store hadn't opened yet. And it was very sleepy on Madison Avenue at 10 o'clock. And the gates weren't up, and we heard the gates rattling, and we looked out, and there's some guy trying to get in, and we started to say, we're not open yet, and then we realized, holy, is that Robin Williams? Well, of course we'll let him in. So we let him in. It was just the two of us and him, and he wandered around. He might have bought a book, maybe not, I don't remember. But when he came to the register, he launched into one of his riffs, and it was just the two of us, and it went on for 10 or 15 minutes. I remember it involved a corn cob that was on the cover of one of the books on the counter. It involved my earrings, and the register was in there as well because it was an old-fashioned register. It was 25 years ago. I don't remember any more of the details, but it was extraordinary, and this other fellow and I just stood there with our jaws dropped.
It sounds like an extraordinary moment. By going into an improv riff like that, do you think he was trying to connect with you or not have to connect with you because he was performing?
Both. I mean, our essential feeling was how exhausting it must be to be this man.
Yeah.
I mean, we were. It was hilarious, but it was strange and bizarre. Yeah. And what, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe he was anxious just being alone with two people.
Yeah.
It was impossible for us to know.
Star.
And then there, you know, there.
Kim, that's
with
a great.
With no further ado, he just walked out of the store.
Thank you very much for that memory. And by the way, we're kind of agreeing to the request of his family, which is to focus, at least in this first pass of conversation on this show, on his the joy that he brought to people. Maybe later in the week we'll do something on, you know, the issues of depression and suicide as the death of Robin Williams raises. But right now we're just remembering him as a person and an actor and a comedian. And Nicholas in Highland, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, how you doing? So throughout the 80s, as you may remember, the comedy club thing just got real big in New York. I'm a cameraman, cinematographer, lighting designer. So here I am, this young guy. I'm 30 years old. I got a camera on my shoulder. I'm sitting on the front lip of a stage, I guess at the Laugh Factory maybe. And he's on stage, and he is just going wild. I cannot hold a shot. I can't. I'm roaring. So he rescues me. He comes over and makes me a part of his bit. Comes, sits down next to me, starts directing. Fast forward 3 years. With Alan King interviewing Robin Williams as a part of a show he did called Inside the Comedy Mind. I'm a lighting designer. I'm sitting in the studio. We were laughing in the control room. We were laughing so hard that the sound came through the glass and spoiled the track. But the sound man couldn't tell because he was laughing so hard.
We just have 30 seconds left, but, you know, I saw the film critic David Edelstein on TV last night say movies failed mostly to capture his improvisatory, freewheeling self. And I guess you're talking about that a little bit, how tough it was technically even for a cameraman when Robin was being Robin.
Unbelievable. So to cap it off, he was living in the Upper West Side at the time, which I was. I get out of a cab on 74th Street,
5 seconds.
Walking down the street, and there he is, and he goes, "You again?"
Thank you for your call. Thank you all for your calls. And we'll end with a clip of Robin Williams that we honestly had a bit of hesitation about playing because it's just being played everywhere. And it does take on a particularly maudlin tone coming on the heels of his death. But it's a brilliant moment and powerful. And we'll let it stand on its own as the last word. Robin Williams quoting Whitman from Dead Poets Society.
Poetry, beauty, romance, love. These are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, "O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish. What good amid these, O me, O life? Answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. That the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?